inspiring and equipping you to live the life you're destined to live. This is the Ascend Men podcast. This is the first of a two-part season called Through the Lens. Who doesn't appreciate or get emotional at a good photograph or video sequence? Whether that's the result of a napalm attack on a naked nine-year-old Vietnamese girl or an awesome scene on planet Earth. I'll let the stars of the show, Andrew Wilkinson and Jeremy Dawson, explain what they do in a minute. Literally. But here's a short intro to each of them. Andrew was born in Hitchin, now lives in Cambridge, is married with three daughters, started work running his own building company before some facilities management and procurement, could probably also be considered as one of the founding members of the C3 Church, and a quote that I love of Andrew's, "It is the photographer who makes the picture, not the camera. Equipment really doesn't matter until it does." Welcome, Andrew.
Hello, Alan, and hello to Jeremy. Thanks for inviting me here, and it's great to look forward to a good discussion.
Great, we're looking forward to it too. Jeremy grew up in Christchurch, New Zealand, lives in Waterbeach, just outside Cambridge, is married with a son and a daughter who have flown the nest, and was previously a professional dancer. And a quote I love off Jeremy's resume, "Image and movement combined in a passion that now shapes my work." Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks very much for the intro, Alan. I'm both nervous and really looking forward to this conversation.
Nothing to be scared about. So we're going to get deep really quick here with some quickfire questions to get to know both of you. So, number one, do you wash your packaging before recycling it?
Mostly, yes.
I'd have to go with mostly yes, although my family might not agree.
Good stuff. Number two, who's your hero?
Tricky one. Jeremy, you go.
For the topic we have, I'll go with Peter Jackson because he's a fellow Kiwi and has done some fantastic things.
Andrew?
Well, I'm going to say my father in many ways. I have huge respect for him. I would love to emulate and model myself on his life. I won't explain what that was particularly, but he was a musician, a conductor and so on. But just the way he managed things. Mm. So I'm thinking more about him, since he's died aged 102, wishing so much I had asked him many more things about how he succeeded in what he did. But he was a great example.
Great, great. And number three, have you ever been up the Shard in London?
No, I have not.
Yes, I have. I went up to the viewing platform level.
Right.
I don't know if there are any other levels, but that was the obvious one to go for. And I have a couple of really nice photos.
And Jeremy hasn't. So that's good in a way, because I'm going to take you on a ride on this podcast in the lift from level 1 to level 68, which takes a total of 60 seconds. During the journey, I'd like each of you to tell the other what you do. So you have 30 seconds each. And Jeremy, I'd like you to lead us off from the ground level.
Doors closing.
Hi, so I work as a gaffer and director of photography in, broadly speaking, the film industry. I do some corporate videography as well, but my main work is electrics and lighting on film sets. I think that's my 30 seconds up just about.
Level 34.
So, yes, a frustrated pilot, architect, building contractor, director of FM and all of that. But I think I've finally reached where I wanted to become, and that is a professional photographer. So I'm a freelance commercial photographer, lifestyle, weddings, that kind of thing. But I'm looking to change this a little bit.
Level 68. Doors opening.
That was really fast. If I was so fast, it made my ears pop. Thank you very much. Now, to put what you just told us into context, can you tell us a little bit about the best project you've ever worked on? Jeremy?
Look, I've worked on some fantastic projects. So in the interest of not offending anyone whose project I've worked on in the past that is not today classed as the best project, they're all wonderful. You're only as good as your last job. And my current job is working on a Christian-themed TV series called Testament, which is based on the Book of Acts. And it is quite literally a dream and a prayer come true, because it is a job that's providing income for me and is putting the values out that I believe in the world in a way that I think will resonate with a very wide audience. Yeah, that's to me just really is the dream job, and I'm working on it currently. So
great. Sounds great. Andrew?
Well, for me, I mean, I could choose a few, but one that's just come to mind that I really, really enjoyed and I think would be my dream repeat job, if I could put it that way. I was commissioned to do a book of Queen's College for Lady Susie Digby, who's the wife of John Digby. Now, Lord Eatwell, I beg pardon, he was the president of Queen's College, Cambridge, my father's college. And he's retiring within a year of this project. So Susie Digby, who I got to know because Queen's put on an event for my father's 100th birthday, she asked me if I'd like to undertake this commission. So I did, and it took a year to do, pretty much. And I had, you know, sort of access any time to go absolutely anywhere around the college. Absolutely fascinating. And I think commissions of that nature, paid ones, really, I think, you know, they sort of endorse me as a photographer. And she gave me the best sort of, you know, recommendation and citation, whatever you like to call it, ever.
Great. I'm going to come back to that in a minute, the commissioning part, because I'm really interested in that in a second. But I want to go back to what Jeremy just said about values. I have a question now, which is whether you've ever turned down a job because of your values or standards or maybe where you're coming from in your faith and where they didn't marry up with what the job involved?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The short answer is yes, I have turned down jobs for that reason. Probably not as often as I would like to have with hindsight, but I have. It's a tricky one, especially if you're starting off at a career, because you know, you need to have income and you also need to have contacts. You need to get to know people. You need to get spread your reputation throughout an industry. Mm. So sometimes the consequence of turning down a job can be quite significant. And in the early days, I didn't really turn down jobs for that reason. I have since begun to turn down jobs, not because they were bad jobs or bad people or necessarily bad projects, but they were things that didn't marry with my personal mission statement.
Well, that's really interesting, Jeremy. And I concur with everything you kind of say there in principle. My own experience is that I have declined one job on, for moral reasons. And I was phoned up by a gentleman who wanted certain photographs, and apparently he'd been ringing around every photographer in Cambridge and I think had been turned down by every one of them. I suddenly thought to myself, if I said I'm going to charge you £10,000, would I change my mind, if he said yes? But I didn't follow that up. But you know, it's funny the thoughts you have, where are your limits, where are your bounds? But I did turn one down, just the one I was supposed to have been doing immediately before this podcast. I pulled the plug on it because we had talked to the client about, Andrew charges us very reasonable rates, et cetera, et cetera. And for about a week, I assumed I was going to be paid something. And when they said, oh, no, we're not going to pay you anything, I just said, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to find somebody else. So I just pulled the plug on that.
And Andrew, you're talking about photographing the college. And to me, that sounds very photogenic. Like it would be hard to take, I mean, I'm sure you could take bad photos, but there must be some great scenes and things to capture there. But on your website, you do say, as a photographer, I will naturally try to convey the truth of a situation. Mm. Yeah. And that really interests me because I'm wondering whether you've ever gone to photograph something, or in your case, maybe video something, Jeremy, which looks absolutely dreadful. And yet you've been commissioned, you've been paid a fee to make them look good.
Oh, yes, yes.
And therefore, maybe what they're expecting and what you're being given as raw materials are two very different things. In other words, have you ever had to put lipstick on the pig?
I think there are probably two aspects to this. One is that there's a situation where truth really matters. Mm. And there's another situation, I'd say more like the college situation, where perhaps it's memories that matter more for them. I remember throughout my life in general, becoming quite distressed about seeing clips on the news, crowds and mobs almost baying for blood because somebody had been accused of doing something. And my inner turmoil was, leave them alone until, you know, they've had their trial and they've been proven one way or the other, because you just don't know the answer. And that stuck with me. And then it just came back into my life in quite an impacting way when I started doing photography for real, you know, 12 years ago when I started. And occasionally I get to teach students about photography, not just about the you know, the technicalities. In fact, I can't really do that because they all have iPhones. I mean, okay, it's a camera, I have to admit, rather reluctantly. But so I talk to them about other aspects of it, and one is about truth. I deliberately keep it as a subject. And so I will show them photographs and I will just say, tell me what's happening here. And what comes out is they describe what they're seeing. But in that come masses of assumptions, like, oh, they must have done this, they must have done that. And then when I reveal the truth, they're really gobsmacked and taken aback and thinking, my goodness me, you know, I would have made a really bad mistake had I had to, you know, commit them to some kind of, you know, punishment or make a decision based on what I just saw. So I think it's so important to remain a little circumspect. You know, I don't mean be fearfully you know, suspicious or, you know, of people or, you know, like that. No, I like to take people at face value. And then I think, well, I'm not going to jump to any conclusions. I'm not going to rush in like a fool. I want to understand more. And so I will endeavor to do that. And just very quickly to round that off, you know, these students, I put an object, let's say it's a beautiful, beautiful apple on the table. Now, the students are all round, so I'm getting them to describe exactly what they're seeing. And some will just say, you know, this is what I see. Others will make assumptions. And I sort of almost encourage them to make those assumptions and to fully describe it. And then at some point, just for this illustration, I will turn the apple around and I'll just say, well, look, you never saw the bite I took out of the back of it.
Lovely.
How does that make you feel?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a slightly different take on that, but pretty much all I do is change what is in front of me. You know, the classic is, you know, we hate to shoot cinematic material in a small white room, but quite regularly I'm given a small white room to shoot something in. And then the director's vision will be, you know, Westminster or something like that, some palace room. And they say, I want to look like this. So my job is often to make that small white room look as much like their vision as possible. And sometimes the transformations are dramatic. I jokingly say sometimes, and perhaps should have started this conversation with it, when people say, what do you do for a living? I say, well, I go into people's houses and I move their stuff around. Because, you know, you'll get to some CEO's desk and the CEO may be an incredibly well-organized person who runs a, you know, Fortune 500 equivalent company, but their desk might be an absolute mess. And the last thing they want on their video is their desk to look like a mess. So you get in and you tidy up all their cables. You move away their pictures of X, Y, and Z that are not relevant and so on. So I think perhaps fortunately and perhaps unfortunately, most of what I do is... it's a bit of trickery, maybe.
It's trickery. And kind of linking back to what, Andrew, you just said about students with iPhones, I guess we've got some incredible technology in our pockets these days. You know, the iPhone 15 has a 48 megapixel sensor in it, 26 millimeter equivalent f1.6 lens, if that's true, and some incredible powerful processing software behind it as well. So what we're carrying these days in our pockets is remarkable. Does that threaten what you do?
Does it threaten? I used to think it did, but I'm more reassured now that it needn't. But I say that in the context of a world that is so quickly moving. And I think the issue is that if you sort of, you know, plow your own furrow and you're just getting on with your stuff that has meaning and value to you, and, you know, you're sort of developing your style and you're putting, you know, you, your observations, your thoughts through whatever medium out to the world, I'm not sure. I think it's almost like the audience that used to receive that is perhaps diminishing because, you know, they're distracted by so many other things. And that's become the norm. And so, you know, I then think to myself, well, what is the point of it? And, you know, I come back to that fantastic Ecclesiastes 3 thing, you know, everything is meaningless. What is the point? And I mean, I could possibly come back to this a bit later, but I did say before that I was thinking of, you know, reviewing things and just looking to go in sort of new directions. And this is part of it. This has sort of stimulated that thought process a little bit. But I'm not really there on any of that. And I need to think about it more. But AI is so powerful. And I think that's what we're talking about, you know, ChatGPT and I forget what the sort of graphics ones or the photographic ones are called. I tend to avoid any kind of contact or notion of even trying to use those because I think it's all about intention. You know, this is the value of it. Does it threaten me? Well, that was your question. I like to think not at the moment. You know, I think I'm still holding my own, but it could easily do because most companies could do their own headshots and, you know, they could cover their own events by just collecting all, you know, iPhone images and all the rest of it. So maybe I need to redefine my market and find it again, you know, and find who's in it. So, you know, it's up in the air, but everything moves so quickly.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of what I do, well, it's really a perspective question. I mean, yes, it does threaten things I'm currently doing. You know, I go into spaces and light them for people, go into spaces with a camera and video it, and the text-to-visual software already can do that. I have some colleagues that have put a short film together set in the Victorian era, which they just typed in the words and it appeared, and then they changed the words, it appeared differently. And I think that's still fairly cutting edge, but maybe. But it's certainly doable now. So the need to have a gaffer turn up and plug in some big film lights and someone else come along with a camera is not going to be the same in a few years' time as what it is now. But it also excites me because the jobs will be required for people to do certain things, even if in an advisory role. You know, we used to always use tungsten lights and have large teams of technicians to get those working because of the generator and power requirements, etc. Now we're using mostly LEDs, and we can. I was at a town hall in London the other day, doing what would have required a very large generator off a couple of block batteries with some LED lights. I think there's still going to be a requirement for people to do things, just maybe not quite what we're doing now.
There's one of my clients that I've done quite a lot of work for over the. 7 years maybe. I'm always doing their events and graduations. They're a big computer coding training company based in Cambridge. And my goodness me, you know, their growth is just accelerating exponentially. But what they keep saying to me, we just love working with you, Andrew. And I think, well, that's great, you know, people to, you know, person to person. And that you know, really sort of gives me a lot of energy to hear that. They could just do all, you know, they're a tech company, basically. They could do it themselves.
Right. So next week, we are going to be talking with editor Rob Davies, and he has some questions for you.
Hey, chaps. How are you doing? It's Rob here, editor. I think I'm on the show next week, and Alan asked me to ask you a couple of questions. So one of them is, when you come back from a shoot and the editor sees your rushes, your footage, what would you like them to say, or what would you like their reaction to be?
Well, the quick answer is I'd like them to turn around and say, well, my work's going to be nice and easy here. Thank you very much.
So that's your objective, to give the editor an easy job, yeah?
Perhaps easy is the wrong word, or that was the word I chose. Yeah, I don't want to turn up missing all the B-roll and have the editor having to search through archives to try and get something to piece together the inadequate footage I gave them. So I'd rather they have the ability to then tell a story. They can then be a storyteller sitting in the edit rather than just putting together what I've got and making something by the skin of their teeth. I look, invariably, I'm pleasantly surprised. I sometimes think, gosh, I haven't given them very much. I feel a bit, you know, how are they ever going to get something out of this? Then you see the final product, you're like, that's incredible. People like Rob and his colleagues have just, you know, they've certainly done a fantastic job with what we give them.
Great. Andy, does that question apply to you?
Not strictly. I mean, I am my own editor. That's the great, that's the good thing. But I'm not always very kind to myself. Mm-hmm. And so I come back from a shoot and I look at what I've done and I think, I just start beating myself up. But then when I'm through it, the people who have commissioned me will basically say, that's fabulous. You've just captured everything we wanted. That's really great.
Yeah. So I'm not sure whether the second question will be kind of similarly weighted more towards Jeremy, which is not a surprise given that the work that Rob does is much more around video than stills. But here's another one.
And the second question is, have you spent any time in the edit? And if so, how does it inform your filming style or ways or shot lists?
Yeah, look, I'll take that one first as well then. I have spent some time in the edits, not on any large pieces, but it is absolutely vital, I think, for a videographer, cinematographer, and I'm sure director as well, which I'm not, to have spent time in the edit, because you're sitting there on set and you need to have an understanding of, if I have a shot from this end of the room and I what's the consequence of that going to be for the shot from the other end of the room for the editor? Will that match from a lighting point of view as the sun goes through the sky, or will it match from a continuity point of view for other reasons? And even sometimes it's a case of saying, look, we've got 20 minutes left because the child actor's time is up and they have to go. It's the law. So we have 20 minutes left for whatever reason. How can we get this 10 shots that we were supposed to do? How can we pare that down to 2 or 3 and still complete the scene? Mm. If you have no knowledge of editing and how to put that together, you couldn't do it. So yeah. I have, and I wish I'd spent more. I think it's vital.
I think for me, there are a lot of lessons learned as I go through editing my work. But I'm trying to increase my hit rate. It's pretty good anyway. But I always remind myself that, in the days of film, when I was using film cameras, what a wedding photographer could do there is photograph a wedding and tell a complete story in 48 frames. So you're creating value. People wouldn't accept that today. They're expecting 350, okay. But I hear of photographers who come back and, they're doing YouTube uploads and saying, I took 3,000-4,000 images. And I'm thinking, if that's the case, you're kind of going blind. You're losing something. And that's my opinion. Now, it might be a bit harsh, but I'm trying to take it the other way. I will always just get that extra shot in case I don't get the one I'm anticipating, possibly. So often somebody just stands up in front of you at a wedding, it's gone, the moment's gone. So there is a lot of luck to timing. You can anticipate all you like, but something can just go very wrong. And then I just learned from schoolboy errors.
Yeah.
And I think, there's a certain amount of creep that goes on with technical equipment. And you think, I forgot to turn that off or to reset that. And I'm wondering what's going on. And, and then something's coming up in about, a minute and a half, like the signing of the register. And you think, but I don't know. The internal panic, I don't think it's seen on the outside, but, it's still there. It never really goes away.
Very good. So the final question I know will apply to both of you. So here goes.
And the third one is, there's lots of freelancers unemployed at the moment. Broadcasters, commissioners aren't commissioning as much. Viewing habits are changing. Has it affected your work in any way? And if so, how have you changed what you do or who you work for?
Well, I can give a response to that. I had a lot of eggs in one basket, and one client really isn't using photographs anymore, or they're using another photographer, but I'm not seeing the output of new works, that they've had photographs anywhere in there. Sort of social media and marketing. So I don't know what's happened there, but what's happened to me is I don't have that revenue stream, and it was very, very useful. So I am trying to think of other ways of finding a new market. I don't want to be, I loathe marketing. Actually, I'm utterly useless at it. I just don't understand. Somebody says, go on to this platform or that program or do something. And I might watch a YouTube video and I get into it and then everything is different. It's not like my dialogue boxes are not the same. And I'm thinking, you know, this is hopeless. It's too much work. And this seems to be like a consequence of the modern age. I know I'm sort of slightly going off now about an IT brand, but yes, it has affected me. And I do need to find some newer, but like slower clients. And I do have a few ideas, but I do need to do something about it as well. And I'd like to think I could make a success of that.
So there you go. If anybody's listening to this and wants to give Andrew some help, you know where to find us. Jeremy?
I've been very lucky. I don't think that what Rob describes has affected me too much, mostly because I'm still at the growth stage of what is not my first career. The very early days, someone said to me, you know, Jeremy, whenever you're on film set, just make sure that you are kind, useful and available and you'll keep getting work. Mm. And I can speak with genuine experience from the few times that I haven't been kind, useful and available, I never got any more work. And so I just try and live those very, very straightforward values every time I'm on a film set. And I agree with what Andrew's saying in terms of marketing. Other than that, I'm terrible at it. The closest I got to doing some marketing was I looked back and sort of did an analysis of all the clients I'd had over a 2 or 3 year period. And I realized that 94% of my work was repeat clients. Mm. So it was not someone looking me up on a website or not someone, you know, going through any other marketing than simply saying, I've worked with Jeremy before and I'd like to work with him again. Now, I don't know if that's a weakness or a strength, but it's certainly, I'll take it as a strength. So I've been lucky. I haven't been affected by loss of commissioning because I've worked for quite a lot of people and most of them keep employing me.
Yeah, that's basically my experience too, that I don't think I've ever had a job through my website. I'd always refer people to it for credibility. But even back when I was building, taking a quarter page in the Yellow Pages, I thought, you know, I'm guaranteed work. I don't think I got anything from that.
So Yellow Pages is definitely history. A lot of people listening to this won't even know what that is. But I want to look to the future, not the past, okay? So looking to the future, photography, filming, lighting, other than LEDs, you know, hasn't changed a huge amount in a century or two. I mean, I'm being a little bit provocative here, but the technology at the end of the day, you grab images, like you grab one image or you grab lots of them very quickly, but you're grabbing stuff. Oh, things are getting faster. There's more memory. There's more this. But fundamentally, it feels like the same thing you're doing, but you're doing it better. What's the next big thing? The paradigm shift that's going to change the world. You've already mentioned AI. Maybe that's it. But anything else?
I'm not sure I can't think what else there will be. I mean, AI is kind of massive, and you just put your thoughts out there and AI will fill in the gaps, if you like, and you can then sort of tweak things. It'd be interesting to know what is of interest to people, though. I mean, AI is very creative, but it's kind of very random, you know, in a way. I mean, what is it that people are looking for, you know, that you can then deliver to them? It looks like you're just putting output out and then people sort of like it or they don't. And it's as short-lived as that, really. Now, yeah, of course, over time, there have been massive improvements in technology from film to digital and all the rest of it. But still, the most powerful thing there is your imagination or what you see, your mind, you know, your eye. And then you follow that by just getting an exposure and depth of field by the means you do. And so I have cameras whereby I think 90% of the features on it are completely redundant, just for one vital feature, which is, you know, perhaps silent photography in a concert, for example. Otherwise, I would go back to my first digital camera. It's absolutely fine.
Yeah, I'd be much the same as Andrew. I really wouldn't profess to know what the future is going to be. The technological changes, even in the 6-7 years I've really been doing this in any seriousness, have been profound. I feel it's much more than simply a case of we're doing the same thing, only better. I mean, we have LED volumes now where, you know, you can walk into a room and you're not green screening, you're walking into a room and although it's under the bonnet dramatically more complicated than this, you know, essentially with the press of a button, you can go from Paris to New York to the moon to some make-believe world to whatever. I think, really without the use of any AI, that's simply a designed world that someone has created, and the actors can interact to a certain degree with that world. And that's profound. And with pixel mapping lighting, there can be lighting that will mirror that world. So in a screen in the background, you'll be seeing whatever displayed, which will be captured real time in camera. But then the LED lighting around the rest of the room, however you've set it up, will be matching that world in real time. Maybe that is just doing the same thing, only better, but it really has changed what a director's imagination can then give to a screen.
I guess where my mind is, like, where are the other senses? Like, where's my sense of smell when I watch something? Or how immersive is it? Where's the virtual reality? How can I look around things? Or how do I interact with the thing that I'm looking at? Can I go in and, you know, and stroke the animal that I can see on the planet program that I'm watching? For me, those are the things that, you know, they'll arrive. I mean, yeah. when they arrive is a question, but those things are all there somewhere in the future.
Well, in part, didn't they do that in cinemas? They would sort of blow the wind and rock your chair and maybe introduce a smell or something like that. But I mean, I think, you know, we're destined, aren't we, in that case, just to be, you know, sat at home, hands in a glove, looking at a screen or goggles, and that's it. I mean, where is it all leading? I mean, I ask, what is the point?
So 4D cinemas certainly exist now, and I think there's even terms for 5D cinemas. So they're exploring all those senses, but they're far from mainstream, and I don't think in their format now. My opinion would be that they're not probably quite the future of cinema. One of the interesting things, do you remember those old books where you used to sort of, you know, you'd say, just make this decision and go to page 32 if you choose to open the door, and go to page 64 if you don't, or whatever. So that's certainly being explored very much now for storytelling on a screen, that people will be able to choose their own story. I have had no working knowledge of it, but I know that it's being done now. People are looking at creating films like that. I mean, there was the Black Mirror one, which was a little bit like that, but I'm talking about not there being one or two options, but literally you choose your options, you choose your story. So you say, I want Tom Cruise to do this today.
Interesting. Sliding Doors is a sort of a little bit of a hint of that.
It is a hint of it, but this will be a case of the viewer would write the story for Sliding Doors as they wanted it to be,
and then could watch it again and rewrite the story
in a different story. Yeah.
I think on many levels I wouldn't like that. I like to enjoy the story that somebody else has written, and I can't really like that. I mean, okay, there are some things that I've watched and maybe wished the ending had been different, but there's something about the cliffhanger, which is great. And so why lose that? And I think we're losing all sense of mystery. That's the thing. You know, I love to stand out and just wonder. I don't want anybody to come and tell me how it works. I just want to look at something and be fascinated by it. I don't know. Am I just...
No,
odd?
I think you're completely right. I mean, you know, one way of wording a good story or a good outcome is, of course it had to be that, but I'd never have seen it coming.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be entirely believable, but you'd never have seen it coming. So if you couldn't have seen it coming, how could you have, you know, written that yourself? It wouldn't have worked.
Well, that's, I think, a great place to stop, because I think that idea of wonder is a lovely place to leave this, because I think that's what you're both doing, is you're writing stories in what you're doing, but you're also creating a sense of wonder. When we look at a picture, it's not just an obvious answer to something. I think that's what you do in your art.
Mm.
Jeremy, I loved your kind, useful and available values. I think they're brilliant, and we could all apply them to everything that we do. So guys, you know, in terms of taking something away from this, think about the wonder, but also think about those values of being kind, useful and available, and you may never be out of a job. It's been a fantastic, fascinating conversation. And I would say, even for those who may not consider themselves as particularly interested in photography, I found this really interesting. And Rob Davies has already introduced himself. He is an editor and has edited footage for Netflix, Apple, Disney, National Geographic, BBC, ITV, Channel 4, Animal Planet, Discovery, and a host of other production companies. So he is well-versed in editing. And so come back next week and have a listen to him, all you listeners. But for now, a big thanks to you, Andrew and Jeremy, your passionate storytellers and your masters of your arts. And it's been a real pleasure having you on the podcast today.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope we've not given you too much of a challenge in the edit, and I hope everyone enjoys it.
That's it for this Ascend Men podcast. If you've enjoyed this content, please share it with a mate. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts. Together, we are stronger.